Welcome to Personal Journeys to Difficult Truths, Understanding Islam, Understanding the West. This is Elsa, and today I have with me
Pamela Geller. Welcome, Pamela.
Thank you so much for having me, Elsa.
I'm going to say a little tiny bit about you, a tiny little bio so people get an idea about you if they don't know you already, and then we'll go right on into the interview. So, your one-line bio really stuck with me. Evil is made possible by the sanction you give it. Withdraw your sanction. Now, there's a lot more to you. You're the founder, editor, and publisher of Atlas Shrugs, and the executive director of the American Freedom Defense Initiative, and Stop Islamization of America. You're the author of Stop the Islamization of America, A Practical Guide to the Resistance, and The Post-American Presidency, The Obama Administration's War on America. And you've done that with Robert Spencer. You're also a regular columnist for WorldNet Daily, Andrew Breitbart's Big Government and Big Journalism, The American Thinker, and more. So I think that's enough of an introduction. So now we'll get right into how you got to be as you are and do as you're doing. Could we start a little with your background? You know, who were you as a child, your personality, family, outlook, interests?
Well, it's not so extraordinary in that I wasn't, I had no exceptional background, although a case could be made that the American experience as a child is quite extraordinary and quite exceptional. I grew up in a typical American household. We were secular, basically secular Jewish. I was one of four girls. I was completely and utterly free, really, in my mind and in my choices, in the way I live my life. I just assumed my freedom. I never even gave it a second thought. I grew up sort of with the idea that the good guys won. You know, it was a post-historical mindset. The good cop America was on the beat, and that the world was my oyster. I had a passion for living, and even as I grew up, the choices I made, I worked all my life, and I was, prior to 9/11, I was the associate publisher of the New York Observer. I was your quintessential, you know, New York career girl. I loved my life. I loved my work. I loved my clothes. I loved my art, my music. And, of course, 9/11 changed all that. I mean, it just, as those buildings came down, so did the whole premise of my thinking. The basic foundation, the basic premise of my assumed freedom was shattered, along with Lower Manhattan and parts of the Pentagon and so on and so forth, that freedom was not free and that it was being challenged and that we had to stand and we had to fight for it. And of course, Elsa, I felt guilty. I didn't know who had attacked the country. And then in the subsequent weeks, I felt guilty that I still didn't know who and why my country had been attacked, and thus began my journey in education.
It sounds like you're not somebody who had much of a religion in childhood, and any interest at all, it sounds like, in Islam, so it wasn't like a long background.
No, I mean, I had as much interest in it as I had in Sikh or Buddhism, or, I mean, it just, you know, live and let live. You know, this is my fight is not a religious battle. It's not religious at all. I don't care if you worship a stone, you know. Just don't stone me with it. My fight and my basic principle is individual rights, which is the basic founding principle of America, is individual rights. And everything noble and brilliant that we achieved as a nation was a logical fidelity to that very principle. So that's the battle. The battle is, you know, whether it's, in this case, of course, it's Islam. There is no unique soul in Islam. But the case is really individualism versus collectivism or statism, whether it was Nazism or communism or Stalinism. The battle, my battle, is for the preservation of individual rights.
Did it take a long time, or was it a very, very quick change when you became politicized, if I can use that word, because that's what it feels like, or when you suddenly became committed or involved?
Well, I was always a committed and involved human being. I was committed to the business of living, and I see what I'm doing now is an obvious reinforcement of that. I mean, my family, and I consider my nation my family, was threatened. And so there was no alternative. To me, not doing anything or sticking your head in the sand or ignoring it is far more dangerous than taking the battle on, head on, which is the way I've approached this. There's no other way to do it. So I don't feel that I've changed. I think that the resolve of America has changed, and I lay blame for that at the door of the media. I call it the enemy media or the Sharia compliant media. Mm-hmm. They are misinforming the people, the American people. You can't make a good decision if you don't have good information. I mean, it's just not possible. And so that's where right now I believe the fight is in the information battle space. And while it's David versus Goliath, you know, because the world media and the American media, I mean, is very, very influential. It's David and Goliath, but, you know, David won. So that's where I rest my hopes on the David, you know, analogy.
It sounds like now a huge amount of your energy is taken in with Islam speaking, writing, and everything. Was this an almost immediate evolution, or did you slowly take on one speaking, one writing? What was your progress through all this?
It was all very organic, Elsa. When I learned who had attacked the country, I wanted to understand why, so I began reading about Islamic Jihad and the, you know, 1,400 years of jihadi wars, land appropriations, cultural annihilations, and enslavements, which led to the slaughter of over 270 million people. I read Ibn Warraq. I read Bacheor. I read Robert Spencer. And increasingly, I found that the media was either clueless or complicit. It was irrelevant what the motive was, but they were clearly not on top of this issue at all. And the only place I would find this kind of relevant news and, reportage and research was online. And I found myself commenting on, counter-jihadist blogs, which at the time the number one blog was Little Green Footballs. And you see what's happened there. He's completely lost his mind. But at the time, it was the premier counter-jihad blog. And one of the other commenters sent me a template for blogging and said, you should blog. And I was like, blog? I don't know anything about blogging. I wouldn't know where to begin to blog. And he sent me the Blogspot template. And he wrote back, he's like, just shut up and start writing. And that's really what happened. In late 2004, I penned an op-ed piece for a local newspaper. And it felt right. And I didn't really question it. I got this Blogspot template and I started blogging and I've never stopped. I literally every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for now what is eight years, I blog every day. And what began as sort of a clarion call of wanting to report underreported news or news that wasn't reported at all, that led to my doing my own reportage of anti-Israel rallies, anti-war rallies, anti-Bush rallies that were not covered, and they were outrageous. They were outrageous displays of hate and anti-Semitism, and I would cover them on Atlas, and that led to my doing original reportage. And then the more I learned of certain aspects of Islam, honor killings, the subjugation of women, my first initiative was to get a headstone for a victim of honor killing in Canada who is buried without a headstone because, of course, as you know, in honor killings, you know, you want to erase the fact that that family member ever lived, let alone mark their grave. And so that's what began, I guess, my human rights activism. So it was all, there was no pre-thought to it. It evolved most organically and most naturally. And I have to say, I'm very proud of much of the my human rights work, much of what I've accomplished in the way of rallies and protests. The most well-known, of course, the Ground Zero Mosque, where we had tens of thousands come. And the conferences and the symposiums and this international freedom conference that we are holding, I'm organizing on September the 11th at 3 o'clock at the UN Plaza Millennium Hotel to fight the Sharia and the Islamization of the West, the imposition of these blasphemy laws. Under the guise of, it's always packaged as hate speech, but it is what it is. You can window dress it all you want. It's the restriction of free speech. And so that's really how it all happened. And it must be done.
I totally agree with you. A little tiny thing on my background. I grew up believing in freedom of speech and all that. And I was just astounded about 10 years ago when I kept bumping into stuff like... you can't offend people and stuff like that. And it was like, I thought one was supposed to ask questions and look. And I realized I was inside myself, I'd feel afraid of bringing things up in classes. And it was like, what is going on here? And I have a question for you. Did it sounds like it kind of stunned you, or I know I was stunned at this change, and I spent a lot of time figuring out what was going on here. Why was this happening at this time in the West? Have you been massively stunned and with the major Western outlook these days?
I was stunned by 9/11. That was stunning to me. I am stunned that the work of people, my colleagues, the few that dare to fight for freedom, dare to speak up for human rights, are marginalized, are demonized, are defamed, are rendered radioactive in defense of freedom. This is altogether stunning. The left and the Islamic supremacists have all but destroyed my reputation. It is most disheartening to see the West's response. Of course, there are always going to be enemies of freedom. This is an internal battle. This is a battle as old as time, as old as man. Good versus evil. What I find stunning is the lack of civilizational self-esteem, the capitulation to demands by Islamic supremacists. Yes, of course, it is stunning. And it is deadly. And in this surrender in installments, and that's what this is, will really render all of this enlightenment and this period of freedom and individual liberty obsolete. And we will enter a very dark age. And I'm seeing it, you know, I see it every day.
It absolutely has stunned me. What does one do?
Well, the antidote is truth. And truth is the recognition of reality. Part of the problem is the education system. The children are not taught how to think. They are taught what to think. Their brain is crammed with garbage. I mean, they show an inconvenient truth on public school and private school screens. They don't teach cursive anymore. The United States spends more than any other nation per student. And yet we're ranked 27th and 29th, respectively, in math and science. this is the problem. And so it's important for us to get voices like yours in the school system, challenging children to think. I mean, on the rare occasions that I speak to students, for example, I'm invited by a professor at NYU to speak to students. What I find most disheartening is that when I leave the Q&A open for as long as I can, at least 45 minutes, not one student, not one, will ever venture off the reservation, ever. It is one barrage of nonstop, hey, racist, Islamophobic, anti-Muslim bigot. I mean, it's just I say at the end of these sessions, doesn't it bother you that not one of you, not one, will go off of the talking points that have been really force-fed to you over the past, I don't know how many years? Where is the diversity of thought? Where is the diversity of opinion? Where is the great debate? Now, it does challenge them to at least think about that, even if you don't agree with me. Where is the discourse? There isn't any. And I think that's very challenging, particularly when I speak. There is a dearth of young people in the audiences. Mm-hmm. And this I find very scary, very scary, which is why I'm such a huge proponent of homeschooling. And giving vouchers to poor or underprivileged children, which they won't do because the left does not want their constituency educated or even, made to think. That's what I think is most horrific about not giving vouchers to underprivileged families and allowing them to choose a private school that... And there are private schools that don't, advance the leftist in inculcation and so on and so forth. Our children's brains are marinating in this toxic ooze. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed almost immediately. The public schools, and how does that happen, is parents must get involved. Parents must get involved. They must get on the school boards. They must get, in the curriculum, involved in the curriculum, and it must be brought up at school meetings, and everybody has to fight.
In this, that you stayed committed for years, have there been turning point experiences, an almost quitting, or you've always just stayed in there and I will stay there, or were some of the turning point experiences good ones? For example, writing a book with Robert Spencer.
Well, first of all of the work is good. It is an enormously fulfilling job to know that you're fighting for what's good and what's right, and that in and of itself is psychic income. Of course, I would prefer a different response than the marginalization and the defamation that I am met with on a relentless daily basis. But, of course, there are moments when, the most obvious, of course, was the defeating of the Ground Zero Mosque. That was, that showed not only to me, least importantly to me, but to the world, the complete disconnect between what the people are thinking and what the media and the culture is telling them what to think. The media and the culture wanted that mosque to be built. They were giving, NBC gave Sharif Al-Gamal, the developer of the Ground Zero Mosque, the Person of the Year Award. He was a man who had defaulted on not one but two bank loans, who had a rap sheet, and prostitutes and what have you, didn't pay his rent, was evicted from his office, didn't pay his taxes, is not paying his rent to Con Ed for that building, and they sued him and he lost. And they're making him man of the year. Why? Because he wanted to build a mega mosque at Ground Zero. So that was an enormously rewarding moment so that people could see how they were being deceived by the media. And then, of course, there are other, the building of a grove of trees in Jerusalem in honor of, in memory of honor killing victims worldwide. When we, you know, effect change, when we get CARE, Hamas, a Hamas operative group here in America, a Muslim Brotherhood group, thrown out of the classroom. You know, this is enormously rewarding, and we're doing these things all the time. And so it is a struggle, and it is an uphill battle because of the machine that we're up against, but it's certainly winnable.
I can hear the optimism and the determination in your voice. It's wonderful. Some people feel that we are very likely to lose, because I've talked to some people who felt, I don't know if we can do it, but we have to do it anyhow. But from you, I hear it's very doable, and we will do it.
Well, if history has taught us anything, it's that the individual can change the course of human events. I don't believe it's over as long as there's one free man fighting, you know, for liberty. Then there's a shot, because we're right. You know, evil can be overwhelming. We saw that during, you know, World War II. And of course, what my fear is, at what cost? I believe we'll win. Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. But my fear, of course, is at what cost? How unimaginable is the cost going to be in terms of, you know, human life, human resources? This is what worries me.
So one of a big goal for you is, how do we lower the cost? Because the more effective
yes.
you are, the lower the cost is.
Yes.
I am totally yes. with you on that, because that makes so much sense. Because sometimes you can win things, but the cost is so enormous. For yourself, I see the strategies you're taking. Are there any strategies you think are particularly effective? I see they're driven by desire. You want to write your blog. You want to express yourself. Which of your strategies do you think, or have you had feedback, is most effective in terms of reaching other people or encouraging other people to join, or however it is? Because what I see is three particular directions. One, you have had natural immunity. You have, in terms of the thinking that you can do, the person who came to 9/11, everything, was naturally immune to being taken in and having been ready to be silent if somebody else said, that offends me. So you have natural immunity. So that's one strategy, to build other people's natural immunity. The other thing is, like, to build a particular immunity, like, you know, to polio or whatever. Like, you know, so you've had both. In fact, you started just with a natural immunity. You weren't interested in Islam at all. But you had the strength that if anybody had come in with anything like that, it was just going to turn you the other way. And then the other direction would be, what works directly against Islamism? Some of the things work for people in the West who are outside Islam. The others work against Islamism, or whatever you wanted. I'm really interested in this because I like to use my energy effectively, and I think you do too.
Yes, I would say, first of all, what my immunity is really rooted in the courage of my convictions. I know, therefore I stand. You know, they can put across any fallacy, and it is a fallacy. It's a myth. The victimhood myth is advanced by the media and so on and so forth. But just saying something doesn't make it so. I have done the work. I have done the research. I'm fighting for life. Mm-hmm. I'm fighting an anti-life ideology. I'm fighting an anti-woman ideology. I mean, this is basic. This is fundamental. And when we think about the voiceless, all of those girls, all of these young girls who are subjugated, oppressed, persecuted, we see it increasingly in the West, in honor killings on the rise, horribly so in Europe, and of course coming here to America, Amina and Sarah Saeed, Nour al-Maliki, Aisha, Asia Hassan, look at their eyes. Look at Aksa Parvez. I mean, this just is just to break the heart. Mm-hmm. who could not stand for that. I mean, I know what I'm fighting for. I'm fighting for, you know, and no one ever really asks me, you know, what are you fighting for? I'm fighting for art and music and love. I'm fighting for life. So it's not difficult. What is difficult is getting the message out, because once you've been labeled as a hate group, I mean, I am five hate groups, okay? I mean, you know, once the attempt to sort of smear and destroy the messenger before the message is even out there is the MO of the media and the culture. And this is the difficulty. And so how I leapfrog over the media, apart from my blog, which of course is a well-trafficked blog, but nowhere near the numbers of, you know, the mainstream media, is by doing these campaigns, these ad campaigns, whether it's for Muslim girls who are, you know, are leaving Islam and have nowhere to go, my Leaving Islam bus ads, or now my pro-Israel ads and my Islamo-realism ads, because the knee-jerk reaction is so visceral on behalf of the politicians and the media. I get to go on television, you know, and say things that Americans never hear. They don't know that there have been close to 20,000 Islamic attacks since 9/11, each one with the imprimatur of a Muslim cleric. I get to go on television and say that. And because I'm running these quote-unquote controversial ads, what's controversial about citing a number, an actual number, an actual fact? It's the truth. But because it is offensive to Muslims, which I don't understand either. Why would that be offensive to Muslims? I would think that the acts of jihad under using, you know, under Islam would be offensive to Muslims that don't want to commit jihad. And isn't that supposed to be the majority? We're told that, are we not? So why aren't they supporting my ads? I mean, why would all Muslims be offended by my ads? That I don't understand. Unless all Muslims support jihad. Is that the message that the media is sending? Actually, it is the message that the media is sending. So these are conversations that need to be had. This is a dialogue that needs to be discussed. And it's not, but many of my initiatives force it to be discussed. And that's where I think my work is most effective.
A very important thing, because most people are just blown over when you say 20,000.
Because they don't know.
No, because what they know is the Norwegian who killed 77, or whatever, however many it was, the right winger. That's the one that comes to mind,
right,
for most people,
yes,
as opposed to the 20,000.
And Breivik, and yes, of course, and Breivik, you know, they tried to blame me for Breivik, even though really Atlas was listed as a news source. I mean, did they try and blame CNN? Did they try and blame the New York Times? They were cited. Barack Obama was cited. Jonathan Locke was cited. Edmund Burke was cited. Mm-hmm. Were they responsible? What's interesting is that, according to courtroom testimony, Breivik's inspiration was Hamas and Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely.
And he said he was driven to it by a media that refused to report on jihad. So, you know, is the media responsible for Breivik? That was a libel. That was a blood libel against the counter-jihad in an attempt to destroy it in one fell swoop. So here you have a guy who, a madman, a monster, who really did work alone, and they're trying to assign blame to me, who was merely footnoted in the news footnotes, and yet here you have 20,000 Islamic attacks. They're yelling Allahu Akbar. They're quoting Quran chapter and verse, but you can't make that connection. It's astounding.
It's totally astounding to me, as somebody brought up to think, that you can't just sue the pants off them and have them running scared, but they, the whole news thing is just totally astounding to me. I know it's happening. I experienced the same thing long, long ago with feminism and with civil rights, where, feminists were called bra burners and man haters. And the problem was there was, rape, battering, incest, etc., which... And so I really am familiar with the name calling, but it astounded me then. It astounds me again now.
It's chilling.
Yeah. And I'm just, how do we break through it? How do we actually make people afraid of calling you names?
Well, look, I really do believe that there will be a tipping point. Mm-hmm. It is a business. I'm in the business of ones, meaning literally you're teaching, you're enlightening one person at a time. It is a business of ones. And so it takes a lot of work and a lot of slogging. But is there anything more worthwhile? Is there anything more worth fighting for, worth dying for, than for freedom? And so it may not be terribly efficient. It may not be the most, I don't know. I can't say it's not effective. I believe it is effective. It's just a very long slog. But what if there was another way that was quicker and faster and easier? I assure you, I would be doing it. but to me, this is the quickest and the fastest and the easiest, as long and hard and as slow as it is. Because the alternative is to do nothing and just sort of wait for the worst. And I have children, and I'm not going to let that happen.
I totally am with you. I cannot imagine just sitting around and letting things happen. I think we've gone over everything that all my questions in terms of who you were, like the quintessential free American woman.
Yeah, freedom loving, totally, you know, freedom is the nucleus of my DNA, and this is why I'm so passionate about the work.
And then you never would have expected this. It's something that happened because of something that happened outside, but when it happened, there wasn't even a choice of turning your back or ignoring it or going on with life as usual, because it was, this matters more than staying on life as usual, because it threatens life as usual.
My country was attacked. Mm-hmm. My country, in the largest and bloodiest attack on American soil. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't get any more personal than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and since then, your life has, it sounds like it's found a stronger center even than before. Like freedom is part of it, but this now gave you more than to live freely. It's to live freely and to deal with this, danger that's coming in that would threaten you. And even if you could live your life to its end without being threatened by it, because this is not a 5-minute change, you want your way of life preserved, that people can have this way of life, not just you and in your generation, to the next generations, like your children and children's children.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's what the fight is for. Look, I lived my life, wonderful, fabulous. Clearly this fight is much bigger than me. It's for the future of, it's for the future of free men. I mean, that's you won't like what comes after America. There's nowhere to go after America.
Well, I'm up in Canada, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Because Canada also has had very strong civil rights and a constitution protecting all kinds of rights. And we also have a massive movement to use those rights so you're not supposed to offend, etc., etc. So we're in the same position, dealing with the same things in a school system which is very close in terms of what it's teaching, which is what got me to put this teleseminar together. What can we do? Also, my thought is that in terms of exactly that name-calling that is directed at you and other people, to show us as humans, first and foremost, this is the person whom you are calling names.
Yeah, that's brilliant, actually. And I think it's wonderful that you're doing this, and I applaud you, and I applaud your efforts. I think it's wonderful.
It's also what I'm interested in. I kind of expected you wouldn't be a monster. And I'm very glad to say you certainly don't come across as one.
Yay!
Yeah.
I'll work harder.
Work harder. Oh, you don't have to work hard at it. It's natural. As opposed to like working at being a monster, I think it's probably harder. Or maybe we just don't have talent for it. Okay, if you have anything else to say, I would love to hear it. Otherwise, I just want to thank you for being willing to have this interview, and I am going to be very happy to present you to all the people who listen so they can get a view of not just what Pamela Geller thinks, but who this woman is.
I think it's wonderful. I applaud you. I hope that you'll send me links. We'll promote it. The attempt to humanize that which has been dehumanized is a wonderful effort, and I appreciate it enormously. You know, I just think it's terrific, and I think that this approach, it needs to be done. You know, we get so caught up in the work and doing the work and the work that we sometimes forget that there's this very human aspect to it. I mean, the whole effort is a pro-human, effort. And so, well done, Elsa. Really well done.
Thank you very much. For me, it was the natural thing. I've been a reader of stories ever since childhood, and I love people like Helen Keller and Elizabeth Blackwell, First American Woman Doctor. And I love their stories, not just their achievements. They got women's rights. But who were these amazing people? So when I was looking for what can I do, this is what in the end came to me. Just as setting up Atlas Shrugs was what was natural to you, doing this is natural to me. And what I really like is, in fact, when I'm talking to different people, hoping that these many different approaches are what does lead us to a tipping point sooner rather than later.
That's what we're working towards. Once you reach a tipping point, and I mean, you don't need everybody, mm-hmm. but you need 30% of the people. Mm-hmm. Then I think you'll start to see things change, and change quickly. Right now, we have elected officials who are craven Quislings. They are appeasing Islamic supremacists and the leftist, and also, you know, the left is a very useful tool to these Sharia-driven enforcers. And so I believe that you'll start to see a different kind of politician. You will find other media that will start to find much wider success, much broader success, and I think things will start to change very quickly. But we have not reached that tipping point yet, which is why everyone's efforts are so important, because the sum will be greater than the parts.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much, Elsa.
Thank you, Pamela.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay.